So I wanted to say something about all three lessons today. This lesson from 2 Samuel, the lesson from Ephesians, and then something about this gospel from John. I continue to encourage you to read the David cycle of stories. It's some of the really great writing of the Old Testament. And the story we hear today is greatly abbreviated and takes away some of the complexity and some of the poignance of it. We sort of pick up the story where Absalom, one of David's many sons, is in revolt against David, his father, the king, and is trying to usurp his father and take the throne for himself, and so has organized a rebellion that has a lot of followers behind him. And David has fled and has gathered his troops, and so they're sort of preparing for their kind of final battles in this revolution. Again, David's life was tumultuous as a royal figure, and so now he's contending with Absalom, his son. And we pick up the story where they're heading out to battle, and he takes his three primary generals and says, for my sake, please deal gently with the boy Absalom. And he's speaking as a dad. And all of us in our family, you know, sometimes it's amazing how deeply we love each other despite the things that we do to each other. And that sort of persistence of love within families, even though there is a lot of pain. And David and Absalom are at one of those points that I would say even exceeds most of what you and I have experienced. So they go out and they talk to you. So they sort of give a summary of the battle, a summary of the slaughter. Then Absalom meets some of the followers of David. And here's where the story gets, I think, compressed beyond warrant. Absalom somehow gets caught in a tree, hanging there by his hair or by his head. And then it said, well, then the 10 tongue young men, the spear bearers, fell on Absalom and killed him. But actually, what precedes that is a fairly perplexing dialogue, because one of the soldiers comes up to Joab, one of the generals, and says, we found Absalom. We've got him. He's caught. And then Joab says, well, did you kill him? And the soldier says, Joab says, did you kill him? I didn't give him 10 weights of silver. And the soldier goes, not for 1,000 weights of silver would I take the life of the king's son. We've all heard what David required of us. Of course I didn't kill him. And then Joab says, well, I have no time for this. And he takes the spear, runs Absalom through. Then the 10 come and finish him off. And then word comes to him. This sort of oblique word comes to David. And he's now no longer in the battle himself. And the word comes back to him. He says, is it well with the boy Absalom? And again, obliquely, may all who rise up against you suffer the same fate as him. And he weeps, David weeps. Says, oh, one of the great, great laments in sort of all history. Oh, Absalom, my son, would that I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. And, wow, this ache that is in David's heart. I quoted that Philip Larkin poem a couple weeks ago about home being a joyous shot at how things ought to be, long fallen wide. How many of us can recognize that in our own families and the ache of wanting our families to be sane and whole and true to one another and somehow overcome the patterns that get set up, and we ache for that. And this again is David maybe this again is part of his sort of spiritual genius, is that he allows himself to be caught in the middle of an ache that is so familiar to so many of us, this ache of family. And sometimes the hardest of all places to work out the mystery of being human and the intimacy and the pain of being in families. And so David, read the stories of David. They're great, great stories from a long, long time ago. Read also Ephesians. It's people generally don't think it's an authentic work of Paul, which maybe make it more appealing to many of you. I don't know. I don't know how strong the anti-Pauline bias is, or if anybody cares at all. I mean, that's also an option. But it's Paul, difficult guy. Ephesians, pretty wonderful teaching about life in community. Again, paste a few refrigerator. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Be angry, but do not sin. So it's allowing you to be angry, and yet appropriately. Interesting question to think of. What is it like to be appropriately angry? And don't let the sun go down on your anger. Still sort of enough of a union to say, great, don't let the day end with you being angry with someone. But also, don't go unconscious about what's really making you angry. Don't let yourself lose awareness of what it is that is actually making you angry. And then it just goes on to say, stop doing things that you know are destructive. Stop speaking badly of one another. Stop gossiping. Stop slandering. Stop arguing. Understand in your heart that it doesn't do any good. And find more constructive ways of dealing with what's really going on. Be kind to one another. Speak the truth to one another, as we talked about last week. They're not a group of rules. Don't slander, don't gossip. I mean, they're kind of rules, but they're more signs that you're seeing yourself in relation to others in a new way. And really what you're seeing is, how are you doing? How are you doing in this travail of life? Are you okay? Are you afraid? Are you sad? Can I do anything to help you? So the shift, the monumental shift, is away from how can you help me? how can you figure in sort of the way I organize my world to, is there anything I can do for you to ease your burden? And that's the shift that we really talk about all the time in the prayer of St. Francis. Finally, just a word about John, and I feel like I'm kind of ducking this. I really would like to take it on in a pretty sustained way. Maybe in a class about Eucharistic theology, where it feels that John, the latest of our four Gospels, feels like we're really dealing here with sort of the Eucharistic theology of the emerging church. And I think that is actually sort of an unfortunate history, and I have my own reasons for thinking that. But it's partly from standing at the other side of the altar for many, many years now, and saying Eucharistic prayers and knowing something of the history of Eucharist and wondering how it is that this meal that almost certainly began as just a common meal. I mean, we get insights into that even in like Corinthians. It's there in Scripture. It used to be a common meal. Probably had considerable continuity with the Sabbath meal of the Jews that began with a symbolic breaking of bread and a giving of thanks. And then when the meal was over, the blessing of the cup and the sharing of the cup. I mean, there was precedent for this. And it was actually quite ordinary. And it was not presided over necessarily by a priest. It was something that you did in your homes. These were ordinary Thanksgivings. And as no surprise for those of you who know me that I think it's sort of unfortunate that over the years and over the centuries and now over the millennia, this blessing, this remembering of Jesus, became a more and more elaborate religious act, and that more and more the churches sort of explanations for what Jesus did in redemption and how, theologies, when the Sanctus bells ring, that means that somehow the presence of Christ is entering the bread. And that all seems sort of forced, and it all seems to put the church sort of at the middle of things. And this literalism about consuming flesh I'm reminded of that, that story, when Jesus was in a boat with his disciples, and he says, "Beware the yeast of the Pharisees." And they kind of go, "What does he mean?" And then they go, "It's because we haven't brought any bread." And Jesus goes, "No, I'm speaking metaphorically. The yeast of the Pharisees, their attitudes, their underlying assumptions that color everything. It's not because you haven't brought any bread." And I can't sometimes think of the whole sort of communion thing of eating flesh and drinking blood, that somewhere Jesus is going, these are meant to be metaphors, and that Jesus indeed is the bread of life. But again, I'm always wary when the church replaces a real mystery with a church mystery. A mystery you have to sort of understand theologically. And so again, you've heard me say this, but whatever occurs in the eating of the bread and the wine, I know that there is one transformation that we all experience. When you eat the bread, and as Emma said last week, this doesn't look at all like bread. we should do something about that. But as we eat that bread and drink that wine, the one transformation that we can count on is that it becomes our body and it becomes our blood. And that we are, again, the real, there is a real mystery that we confront every day, which is, how are we sustained as bodies? And how mysterious it is that we as bodies take things into ourselves in this mysterious exchange of energy with the world around us. We take that energy in, and we don't live without it. And how ambivalent we are about eating. The rules and the religious limitations and the prohibitions and the taboos, this act of eating is such a place of ambivalence for us as human beings. And somehow communion says, be blessed in your eating. In the very heart of creation, the one who gave rise to all of this, wants you to be fed, and wants you to be fed with good food. Real bread. Through all of this, the language of Isaiah said, why do you labor for that which is not bread and spend your money for that which does not satisfy? And Jesus was asking us really to pay attention. Where's real bread to be found? What's real nourishment for our hearts and our souls? What opens our hearts when we hear it or when we taste it? And what leaves us so empty and so famished still, that kind of saying, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. You can never get enough. You crave and eat and consume more, and it's empty and it's dust in our teeth. Let Jesus be the poet that he was. Let him speak to you poetically about being the bread of life and about opening your heart so that you can tell the difference between what really nourishes you and what is just empty food without nutrition and without value. Why do you labor for that which is not bread? get out of some of our literalism. Let's, or at least, let's understand that our religious activities have a history. And we as human beings have created that history. And we have interpreted things in a certain way. But if we've interpreted them, we can reinterpret them. The questions are alive. And I want to give it back to us as a people to think about what these symbols mean for us. And symbols that are so primary, like nourishment, like bread, like eating. And again, for us to have that deep, long conversation among ourselves about what it is that we think we're doing here in the Christian community, what our primary symbols mean. Jesus, the bread of life. But let him be the poet that he was. And there's a time to be literal, and there's a time to be poetic. And I think that this whole area of communion, there's a literal mystery right at the heart of it, but there's a lot of poetry. And so let us learn once again how to celebrate that poetry and receive unsqueamishly this nourishment that we receive in our opening.